I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order on the 23rd of April 2007 at 9:20 a.m. Apologize for starting late, but as we get closer to the end of session, things are going to get a little wilder and sometimes the schedule will be off, but we'll continue to try to start on time. And there will be some delays as we work through the end of session. With me today is Co-Chair Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Elton, Senator Thomas, Senator Dyson. We're going to have two bills on the agenda today. We're going to have a new bill, SB 84, which is testing and packaging of cigarettes. And then we're going to go on to hear a previously heard bill, Senate Bill 125, the Public Employees Retirement Cost Share Bill. Then this afternoon at 2 p.m., we're going to come back in from our recess, and we're going to start SB 104. Now, with starting a little bit late today, we may have to finish up this morning's business this afternoon, but we're going to try to keep on schedule.
When will we get back to the capital budget?
It appears that the capital budget is probably the end of the week, first of next week. Right now, the staff is busy working on governor's amendments and actually drafting the bill.
And when would you like to have our amendments to the governor's bill in?
Well, I think if you have submittals requests for the capital budget, I'd suggest that you get those into my office.
Yeah, I understood the ones for our district and stuff, right. But I was just thinking of amendments. But so you, anytime is fine here in the next few days.
Yeah, I mean, you want to get the information into the office. I think, you know, you probably want to see the bill before you draft amendments to see what's in it. But
yeah, it's
one step at a time.
Yeah, so. Then we can submit them after the bill gets we see the modifications to the bill?
You should have had a memo requesting submittals. I'll have to check with the staff to see if they've received your packet yet, but we can get together after the meeting, Senator Dyson. And it's a work in progress. I mean, we're just starting at the actual technical or the mechanical creation of the bill. We're still in the process of scrubbing the governor's amended amendments coming forward. We just, you know, so it's going to take a while.
Thank you.
Yep. With us today to present Senate Bill 84, testing and packaging of cigarettes, is Senator Donnie Olson, of course, sitting at the table. And what I'd like to do is have him present, or his staff, however he wants to do it, present the bill to the committee, and then we will have questions and testimony. And the intent is to move the bill today unless we find some issues with it that we need to work on in the future. With that, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Donald Olson, sponsor of Senate Bill 84, which mandates that only self-extinguishing cigarettes can be sold in Alaska. Cigarettes are the leading cause of home fatalities in Alaska and the United States, and a quarter of these victims aren't even the smokers themselves. And where it becomes a pertinent situation for me is that when I was practicing medicine full-time, one of the things that came into the emergency room at 4 o'clock in the morning was a little kid that had just survived a fire but was having a lot of trouble breathing because he had smoke rings around the nostrils and he had burned feet where he ran across the floor trying to get out of the house. And so it's been one of those very passion-filled, memorable experiences that I had in my past medical career. And so because of that, this bill has had special weight from myself and my office. And I'd like, with your permission, I would like to go ahead and bring up Denise Liccioli, who's going to, who is an expert on this bill and has been very familiar with it, as well as some of the numbers and more of the details that are there. With your permission, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to call her up to have her present the bill.
Ms. Licioli, if you could come forward and hop in the hot seat and present the bill, it'd be appreciated. And if you could please identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Denise Licioli, and I'm staff to Senator Olson. And thank you for the opportunity to present this important piece of legislation to you today. As Senator Olson said, Senate Bill 84 mandates that only self-extinguishing cigarettes can be sold in Alaska, and also establishes the testing and certification requirements to assure that only self-extinguishing cigarettes are sold in Alaska. Although no cigarette could ever be called safe, so-called self-extinguishing cigarettes or fire-safe cigarettes are reduced ignition propensity cigarettes. These cigarettes are designed to be less likely than a conventional cigarette to ignite soft furnishings such as a couch or mattress. The bill also provides for the marking of cigarette packaging in an approved and easily identified manner to indicate they are fire safe. Cigarettes are the leading cause of home fire fatalities in Alaska and the United States. The most common material first ignited in home fires are mattresses and bedding, upholstered furniture, and floor coverings. A typical scenario for fires is when a lit cigarette is forgotten or dropped by a smoker. The cigarette fire can smolder for hours before it flares up into a full blaze. I would also call your attention, you should have it in your packet, the Juneau Empire article regarding the fire that happened here in Juneau April 4th. And that fire was caused by a lit cigarette that was left unattended and blew into, I believe it was a couch in that case, so it was soft furnishings. One-fourth of all victims of smoking material fire fatalities are not the smoker themselves whose cigarette started the fire. Rather, it's other victims. And over one-third of those victims are children. The risk of dying in a residential structure fire caused by smoking also rises with age. 38% of fatal smoking material fire victims are age 65 or older. The most common technology that is used by cigarette manufacturers for reduced cigarette ignition propensity, which is also called RCIP, is to make a paper thicker in places to slow down a burning cigarette. And I would call your attention to, you should all have this in your packet, it's a picture of a cigarette that has what's called speed bumps in it. And it shows the way that that works is that if you have a cigarette with that kind of that is made with that kind of technology and it's left unattended, when the burn reaches one of the so-called speed bumps, which are the thicker places that you can see in the colored picture you have in your packet, the burning will then self-extinguish. And self-extinguishing cigarettes will meet established fire safety performance standards. Legislation similar to SB 84 has already been enacted in New York, which was the first state, and also Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, California, and Illinois. And just in the last about 5 weeks, we've had three additional states, which are Utah, Kentucky, and Oregon, that have also passed legislation. In addition to that, there is a fire safe cigarette mandate that has been enacted and approved for all of Canada. This legislation is supported by the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association, the Alaska Firefighters Association, and the Department of Public Safety Division of Fire Prevention, AERP, and many other organizations. And I would also add that there is no known opposition to this legislation. None has come to our attention anyway, or that we are aware of. Senate Bill 84 will save lives and also save property and reduce injury in Alaska. And I guess with concern of the Finance Committee, I would also add that there is really zero impact to the bottom line because the revenue that would be generated by the application of the fee that this bill establishes is greater than the expenses that the Department of Revenue expects to have to be able to track the cigarettes that are allowable within the state of Alaska. So with that, I would urge favorable consideration of this bill, and I'm answer any questions you might have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What additional cost is there to a pack of cigarettes as a result of this legislation?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there will not be any increased cost to the purchaser of the pack of cigarettes. So a person who goes to the store to buy them will pay the same price after this as they do before it.
So there's no additional cost to the manufacturer either?
If there is, they're absorbing it, is my understanding. In one of the previous hearings, Senator Hoffman, they said that it was that the difference in cost to them was negligible, so that they basically said there was no difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The markings on the package are simply something that says it complies with a certain piece of legislation or something like that. Doesn't indicate, or does it indicate that there's that's a fire safety? Realize cigarettes are a small package, so there's not a lot of room after some of the warnings and advertising that's already on them. But is that how it is? It just simply makes reference to some statute or something that it comply with the.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas.
Or is there something in here that?
The bill itself does establish standards for marking so that it will be consistent for all cigarettes. And I believe it leaves it up to the discretion of the fire marshal to what those are. However, there are certain markings that have already been established by other states, with New York taking the lead on that. And this bill gives recognition to that and asks that those markings be considered approved markings.
Thank you. And did you get any understanding of how they arrived at the no more than 25% of the 25% of 40 cigarettes, how they arrived at that being the reasonable number, at least to get started with? I suppose this will probably move forward and get up, I guess, too.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, there's an organization called, and I'll put it in front of me so I don't mess it up, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And I believe I gave you in your packets, it's called, it looks like this. And that establishes the standards for what's acceptable. And they have more than just what I gave you online with that. So I believe that that's where that requirement came from.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Noel.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Denise, thanks for the presentation. And if you want to defer this to the department, that would be fine. I guess I'm struggling to understand, you know, the impact on the Department of Revenue and the reason for their fiscal note. It seems to me that they have a section already that does work with, for example, providing lists to distributors and others. And as I went through the bill, it seemed to me the greatest impact was going to be on the Department of Public Safety, especially the Fire Marshal's Office and Department of Law, perhaps. But they've got zero fiscal notes. Have you had a discussion with the Department of Revenue on why they need the additional halftime person?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, yes, we have. And Joanna Bales should be online at the Anchorage LIO for any specific questions that you have. But my understanding of it is that currently they do maintain a directory of cigarettes that meet the tax laws. However, that directory is broader and would contain cigarettes that do not meet fire safe standards that would be established by this bill. And as such, their costs come in by having to refer people that are looking to that list to another list that would contain the specific cigarettes. For example, in the case of Marlboro, which is one that we've used before, the list that they currently have would have the broader, they might have Marlboro, Marlboro Light, or Marlboro Menthol. I don't even know if they have menthol. I'm not a cigarette smoker myself. But the list that is defined within this law would take it down. You could have ultralight, you could have light, you could have all the different what they call styles of a particular brand name of cigarette. And each individual style has to be certified to meet it. So they would have to basically expand their list to include all of the different styles for a particular manufacturer, as well as to not contain those that had not not gone to this technology at all. So they would be different. The two lists would be different. And they expected that it would take a little bit more, a full-time person, once it came into play for part of the year, to get it set up and going, and then after that to simply maintain it would become a part-time job. And I think their fiscal note reflects that.
If the department is available at some point, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me, and I may be missing something fundamental, but establishing a list and maintaining a list seems to be simpler than and less resource intensive, I guess, than I'm getting. And so maybe they can.
We're going to bring him up next month. We're done here. Is there any other preliminary questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, is there any empirical evidence from like New York where they've been doing this that fires have been reduced?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson. They haven't done any full-blown or published any full-blown studies that I'm aware of yet, although they did have some preliminary data from, I think it was about the first 6 months or less than a year after New York instituted their law, which did show a reduction in fires from that.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other preliminary questions? With that, I'd like to ask Joanna Bales from the Department of Revenue, if she's online, to speak to the fiscal note, if she's comfortable with that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Joanna Bales with the Department of Revenue. Can you hear me there?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. For the record, my name is Joanna Bales. I am the supervisor of the excise tax unit within the tax division. And as such, I'm the program manager for the cigarette and tobacco products excise tax. As Ms. Liccioli explained, the Department of Revenue currently maintains a directory of cigarettes that are approved for sale in the state, and those cigarettes comply with the Nationwide Master Settlement Agreement. This legislation would, first of all, change the way that we conduct our enforcement. We also have investigators within our unit who do investigations and inspections for unstamped cigarettes, as well as cigarettes that are being sold in the state that aren't in compliance with our current directive. Under this legislation, we would actually be the primary agency tasked with enforcement to ensure that cigarettes that aren't fire safe aren't being sold in the state. In addition, we would have to compile an additional list. Right now, we have about 200 brands of cigarettes that are on the list that are compliant with the Master Settlement Agreement. We expect that this list of fire safe cigarettes, because of the way this language is written, we would have approximately 1,000 different brands of cigarettes on the list of fire safe cigarettes. And then we would have to compile a third list, which would show those cigarettes that are in compliance with the MSA and those that are in compliance with this new legislation, and conduct an education campaign with our approximately 2,000 retailers and distributors across the state. So based on that, we do expect that we will have some additional duties assigned to our department.
Thank you. Mr. Jerry Burnett, would you like to come forward and speak?
Not really.
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah, this is Jerry Burnett, Department of Revenue. Do you have a question? Or?
Well, we'd like to see a zero fiscal note, if at all possible. But as we move forward and more states adopt this type of cigarette, is it fair to assume then that the inventory in the warehouses would be then virtually all these type of cigarettes, and at the end game, if all the states adopt it, we're going to streamline the issue? Or
It would be my, Joanna Bales actually might be the better person to speak to that, but I would guess that that could happen over time. At this time, though, we will have a bit of additional work, and we do feel that it's necessary to have the staff to do that work. At this point, we do think the fiscal note is reasonable under the circumstances.
Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Jerry or Joanne, it seems to me that, and I admit I may be missing something fundamental here, but the testing is going to be done by others.
Right.
The test results are going to be accepted by the state fire marshal, that what the department is going to get is a list. And that seems to me to be a data entry issue. So I guess I'm struggling with the notion that we need a full-time person for, part of a year, and then a half-time position beyond that, plus contractual costs. If others are doing the testing, others are compiling the list and then giving it to you, I'm just struggling with the notion that we need another person.
To the chair, Senator Elton, I'd like Joanna Bales to speak to what the department actually does in terms of enforcement with this.
Ms. Bales, if you could speak
Senator,
to the issue.
Senator Elton, through the chair, we actually will be compiling the list. Someone else will not. Each manufacturer will provide their cigarette markings to the state fire marshals as well as to the Department of Revenue. So we will compile the list. And in addition to maintaining this list, and actually would end up being three lists, we also, as I said, would be the primary enforcement agency. We will seize cigarettes that are not in compliance. We will also provide the individual whom we've seized cigarettes from with the ability to, have a hearing, and we will be responsible for destroying the cigarettes as well. And all of those items do come with a cost for us. And just, to give you maybe just a little bit of history, when the Master Settlement Agreement passed, the Department of Revenue didn't receive any funding at that time. We also didn't receive funding when the Directory for Approved Cigarettes under the Master Settlement Agreement was also passed. That's a significant amount of work for us just to maintain that directory, because we do receive information all throughout the year. It's just not at one time during the year on those cigarettes. And we expect the same thing under this legislation as well. So, and any time we're asked to absorb additional functions, it does take away from our audit program and other items that we do in the office. So we do expect to incur some additional duties with this bill. But again, there's a $250 fee for each one of these cigarette brand types. The expectation is that there will be about $83,000 that comes into the state yearly, because the certification of these cigarettes isn't required every year. So that revenue from this will more than cover our expenses, but we will have some additional costs.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee members? Let's go to the Fairbanks LIO and hear from Warren Cummings. Mr. Cummings, if you could identify yourself and who you represent.
Thank you, Chair. This is Warren Cummings. I'm president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association and also fire chief for the city of Fairbanks. The Alaska Fire Chiefs Association encourages the passage of this legislation, and we see it as something that's going to save Alaskan lives. If you look at the facts, cigarettes are the leading cause of home fire fatalities in the United States, killing 700 to 900 people, smokers and non-smokers alike, per year. That's almost four per year in Alaska. In fact, in the last 10 years, there's been 37 lives lost because of cigarettes fires in Alaska. Smoking materials structure fires killed 760 people and injured 1,520 people in 1903 in the United States. In that same year in Alaska, there was five fatalities. one quarter of the victims of smoking material fire fatalities are not the smokers whose cigarettes started the fire. And this was reported earlier, but I'd like to put some emphasis on it. And that's 34% of the fatalities are children of the smokers, 25% are the neighbors or friends of the smokers, 14% are spouses and partners, and 13% are parents. NFP research in the mid-1980s predicted that a fire-safe cigarette would eliminate 3 out of 4 cigarette fire deaths. If cigarettes manufacturers had begun producing only fire-safe cigarettes then, an estimated 15,000 lives would have been saved by now. Alaska, over the last 10 years, this would have saved 27 lives. Research in New York State shows no decline in cigarette sales with the introduction of fire-safe cigarettes, but cigarette fire fatalities were reported to have declined in that state by a third in 2004 when the law was in place for not quite half a year. And with that, we would encourage you to pass this legislation not only out of committee but also out of the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Cummings. Okay. With that, I'd like to bring it into the room here and have Mr. Jim Carroll come forward. Mr. Carroll, if you could identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill.
My name is James Carroll. I'm representing here today AARP and Juno Retired Teachers. I'm also a former firefighter myself. And thank you, Mr. Chair. I am here today to represent those two groups, and we are in support of passing this bill. Hopefully you will give it a yes, Senate Bill 84 out of this committee. As I reported before, I was a firefighter for 34 years here in Juneau, and the last several years as a chief. And some of you were probably visited by the Chiefs Association 1st of February in favor of this bill. I won't go into all the details I had planned on. Denise seemed to cover quite a bit of it, and Warren Cummings, who I know very well. Hello, Warren, if you're still listening there. But I am not representing the Chiefs. I do want to fit. Warren's doing that. It's just that AARP and the retired teachers would like to see this bill pass for the safety of those people here in Alaska. So I won't cover anything more. As you probably have the pamphlets in front of you, and the other two seem to cover quite a bit of things that I was going to speak to you on, but I won't be redundant on that. If they have any questions, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer them if I can.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Carroll.
Okay.
Mr. David Hull. It's a scary thought when they show up with a computer.
Hey, I just didn't have any paper to write on, so. My name is David Hull, and I'm the Vice Chairman of Alaska's Council on Emergency Medical Services, or ACEMS. And I'm here with the permission of the Council to speak in support of Senate Bill 84, the Fire Safe Cigarette Legislation. This is an issue that spans the breadth of emergency services. This is why ACEMS joins our partners in the fire service in supporting this bill. This is an issue of life safety. This legislation is not an attempt to regulate the industry or to restrict smoking. It is an effort to curb needless fires from starting from a carelessly discarded cigarette. In my 32 years of emergency services, I've seen many fires start this way. And as stated earlier, one only needs to look locally. A few short weeks ago to the fire that happened here. Capital City Fire and Rescue faced a potential disaster, and they faced it very well. A lit cigarette was left in an ashtray on the arm of a couch that was located on the outside access deck. A gust of wind blew the still-burning cigarette into the couch, and in a very short time, the entire deck, 5 stories of it, was fully involved. Had it not been for the desperate actions of a few occupants by jumping out of their windows and the heroic actions of a nearby construction crew who placed their own lives in danger to rescue some trapped occupants, this fire could have easily been a tragic nightmare. All this from one carelessly discarded cigarette. That is the reason ACEMS supports this bill, and that is why I'm here. So please, pass this vital legislation both here and out of the Senate. Senate Bill 84 is not meant to hurt the tobacco industry. It is meant to save lives and property. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Your testimony. That concludes the list on the sign-up sheets. Is there anybody here that would like to speak to this bill before we bring it back to the table? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the committee. Any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, it's just a comment. I hope that people don't misconstrue this new wording on a small pack of cigarettes, and I read what is contained there, and it looks like a lot of wording being tried to squeeze on a small pack that somehow indicate some kind of safe cigarette, you know, that they're smoking, you know, and kind of almost negates the other warnings. And the other concern I had was, over the years, it seems I've heard that there are cigarettes, the regular tobacco, that don't have all the additives in them, that don't continue to burn anyhow. So I don't know if anybody's got any information on that, but I would have thought the fire departments might have, or the fire marshal might have commented something to that effect, because I know that the ones that are supposedly just pure tobacco without all the additives that you hear, 150 additives or something. Anyhow, it's just a comment. Anyhow, thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Elton.
Just a comment. Mr. Chair, I want to applaud the sponsor for bringing the bill before us, and he gave me the courtesy of allowing me to sign on right away. And so I think it's a very, very important bill, and I think it needs to move. But I would hope that as the bill progresses through the legislature, that we take a look at the fiscal note. I understand, I think, the concerns from the Department of Revenue, but I'd note that the fiscal note that they've prepared does not talk about enforcement. I'm assuming that the enforcement is going to be done by the same people who are enforcing the other things for cigarettes, including the stamps. And I do struggle with the notion that we're going to need an additional person to maintain, or half position to maintain a list. So with that, I would just encourage us to accept the bill with the reservation that the fiscal note will continue to be scrutinized.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Elton. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I generally worry about nanny governments and government intrusions and forcing industries to do things that they ought to be doing on their own. And as I have worked on legislation like, remember, prostate screening last time, and I asked the insurance companies if it was such a wise thing for them to do for their clients, why didn't they do it on their own without government having to force it? And the answer behind closed doors was, we would if our competition would do it. You know, we don't want to have to run our rates up a little and be at a competitive disadvantage. And they were basically said, go ahead and do that because it's good for the patients. It's a wise thing for our industry, but we just want to make sure everybody's on the same level playing field. And I think that's the situation here. We get asked the question, why haven't the cigarette industry done this on their own? My guess is the answer would be the same. They would have if everybody had to do it. And my guess is with New York and California already in the game, that we're going to find that cigarettes, by and large, will be manufactured to this standard just because it's difficult for them to have two production lines. We've seen that happen with automobiles. You know, it ends up being what the big states like California say end up being the standards for everybody. Textbooks, it's whatever Texas does. And I, too, commend the sponsor for this. We'll support it.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. Any other questions? Seeing none, Senator Hoffman, do I have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we pass out CS for Senate Bill 84 Judiciary with individual recommendations and fiscal notes number 3 with the Department of Revenue and 4 with Public Safety.
We have a motion on the table. We hear objection. Seeing no objection, we'll go ahead and move SB 84 on to the next committee of referral, which is rules.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief at ease while we set up the presentation for the SB 125, which is a cost share bill. This is SB 125, which is the Public Employees Retirement System cost share bill. We've heard this bill previously. We have a CS today that we'll get into in a minute, but the intent is not to move the bill today. The intent here is to get the bill back on the table, go through some updated analysis, and there's a few policy calls we're still working on and deal with this, but we want to get this bill sooner than later. It'd be nice to be done with it in the middle of the week here, or at the end of the week at the latest, and move it on. We have the AGEA bill is now at the committee, scheduled to start this afternoon, which will take up a substantial amount of committee time. We've been working with the administration, the actuaries, and the ARM board members, you know, on a different approach. Today I'd like to introduce a new CS, discuss it at the table, and then we'll go from there. And if we could start by having Senator Hoffman move the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we adopt a CS for Senate Bill 125, labeled E, dated February 20th as our working document.
Does everybody have the CS? I think they do. Okay. Hearing no objection, we'll go ahead and adopt the CS. With me today, at the end of the table, a staff member, Mr. Miles Baker, along with Finance, Mr. David Teal. And we're going to start by having Mr. Baker walk through the bill. And then there are several policy issues on this bill that we'll touch on as we walk through it. Just as a quick highlight, the administration's the original bill, there's a 90-day window for amending the participation agreement. We haven't changed that in the CS, but we've heard some concern on that part from the municipalities. So that's an issue for the members to kind of pay attention to. Also, I'd like to discuss whether risk sharing between the state and the municipalities or the munis is necessary for the unfunded liability. Mr. Teal will be addressing that issue. Finally, I think that we need to set some sort of a floor to prevent changes in the payroll base in the future, which is the gaming issue. We're concerned about that. And with that, I'd like to go ahead and have the bill, the CS, presented, and we'll walk through it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Miles Baker, staff to Senator Stedman. And members should have in their packet a four-page analysis of changes, which is kind of a side-by-side of the original bill, administration's original bill, and the committee substitute that you've just adopted this morning. So I'm just going to briefly walk through that with you, and I'm trying not to read it to you, but just kind of explain the changes that that are contained in the version before you. The title has been expanded slightly because, as you will see, there's a new section that puts a slight change on the duties of the ARM Board, the Alaska Retirement Management Board. And although the TERS system is already a cost-share system, the approach we're using with PERS is proposed similarly applied to TERS, so there's some new sections of TERS statutes that weren't in the original bill. And the way this is laid out on the left side is the bill section in the CS, The changes are in the middle, and then on the right side is the corresponding section of the original bill. So in Section 1, this is one of the TERS statutes we've introduced. It repeals and reenacts the employer contribution section of the TERS defined benefit statutes. And over the last several years, the state has basically assumed the unfunded liability for the TERS systems, and the state has made those payments, but we've given that money to the school districts through an increased BSA, and it's been paid out through the formula. And what this section does is change the employer contribution rate for the school districts to the normal cost rate, which this year is 12.56. So it sets the normal cost of 12.56 in statute, which will be, and that's the defined benefit plan normal cost as of the latest valuation. And that will be what school districts will have to pay on their employees. And the rate will apply to the entire payroll base, regardless of tier. So that rate, while it's calculated based on the DB plan, that rate applies to all their employees, so they'll have to put in the full normal cost rate. And that concept was introduced previously in SB 123, the technical fix bill, which we've already passed. So that's actually not new, at least to the committee, concept. These contributions that are then collected by the employers and transmitted to the administration will be used to pay both the normal cost of the DB members and the normal cost of the DC members. And the excess money that's collected, which in the case of TERS won't be significant, there won't be a lot of excess in the case of the TERS system, but whatever excess is collected would then go into the unfunded liability. We're also saying if you have anybody that's a retiree, rehire, regardless of how you're dealing with them locally on an individual basis in terms of whether they're on the active health plan, retired health plan, it doesn't matter. Their full payroll will be used in the calculation, and you'll have to pay it. You'll have to pay the normal cost on them for funding the system purposes, whether they're actually in the active health plan or not. And because of the way we've structured this changes, there was definitions required that weren't in the previous section of statute. This approach, you'll see in a minute, is the exact same approach we're using in PERS, but it works slightly differently in the PERS system. Section 2, also introduces it doesn't introduce a new section, but new to the bill in statute with regard to, I'm sorry, it is actually a new section of statute, which deals with the state's contribution. Because now the state will be taking in this money and it'll be applied to the plan. And this clarifies that the state, for any employees that are directly employed by the state that are in the TERS system, they will also have to pay the 12.56 rate. And in addition to that, the state will have to make a direct payment once a year to the administrator of the system for the amount of money required to fund the full payment due for the unfunded liability. And again, this is not really different from a policy perspective than what we've been doing over the last several years. Just the mechanics are different. That instead of giving that money to the school districts and they then turn around and pay the system, we're going to pay the system directly. I would, going back to Section 1, I didn't mention that even though the rate is 12.56, which is the normal cost as of the latest valuation, in Senate Bill 141, we had introduced the concept of setting as a floor the normal cost that's calculated every year. So going forward, if the normal cost ever drops below 12.56 or goes above 12.56, the employers will have to contribute the greater of the two. Section 3, it's because of these changes, and it was noticed that we made a lot of these changes in 141, but it's important to understand the difference between system, which refers to the entire retirement system, whether it's the public employees one or the teachers one, and plan. And plan refers to whether it's the DB plan or the DCR or the defined contribution plan. So that definition was missing in the TERS statutes, so we just added that to clarify. Section 4 is the section that is added dealing with the ARM board, and we want to, since the state will now be picking up the difference between what the employers are contributing and what the board sets as the required amount to pay off the unfunded liability, we want to make sure that the board doesn't set a shorter amortization period than is absolutely necessary to pay this off, because the result of that would be, if you want to pay the 25-year mortgage over 10 years, obviously the rate is going to go up. And so the actuarial standard in the industry is somewhere between 25 and 30. The board has been using 25. We don't expect them to change that, but we want to make sure that that might not be used in the future unnecessarily. Section 5, no change there. Section 6, basically no policy change, but those sections were in 123 that this committee and the Senate's already passed. We wanted to make sure the language was the same. Jumping down to Section 9, this is basically a new section that does what I previously discussed for TERS, for the PERS system. And the PERS system would now move to a cost share system similar to TERS, which means all employees share in the assets and liability in a pooled basis for the whole system. Employers would pay a fixed rate of 22% on their entire payroll, regardless of tier. Those contributions would then be used by the administrator to pay the defined benefit normal costs and the defined contribution normal costs, and the balance of the money would go to the unfunded liability. Jumping to page 3, section 10, similar to what we discussed earlier in TERS, this adds the piece that hasn't existed before, which requires the state, in addition to paying 22% on its own employees, similar to the other employers in the PERS system, and that rate was contemplated by the committee in the operating budget that's been passed. In addition to making that contribution, the state would make an appropriation to the system of the amount required above that 22% that we've collected from all the other members to meet the board's adopted rate to fund the unfunded liability for that fiscal year. Jumping to section 16, this is an amendment requested by the administration. The bill they introduced hadn't really indicated how termination costs would be determined going forward if an employer decided to completely exit from the system. They asked that to be added. Section 18, just a couple slight changes in the repealing sections. We added 3935-260 of the list of repeals. That's a section that dealt with employer contributions in the PERS statutes. Those are no longer needed because we've addressed it in the new section we rewrote. And it removes 3935-280 for the same reason. The transitional language, subsection B, again, at the request of the administration, we added one sentence, which begins on page 12, line 5. And basically, this would conform our bill to an amendment that was made to the technical fix bill in the House that says that if an employer opts in their elected officials, that they can only opt in elected officials who are drawing a salary, and that salary has to at least be what legislators make on a monthly basis. So that's been adopted in the House on the bill the Senate passed, the technical fix bill. So if this bill were to pass, felt it was appropriate that during this 90-day window, because what this bill contemplates is that if it passes, employers will have 90 days to make any participation agreement changes to their current PERS plan, and then once that window closes, they cannot make any changes in terms of opting in and opting out classes of employees. They can either exit completely from the system as a municipality or as an employer or not. But they will have a 90-day window. So during that 90-day window, if they aren't currently covering elected officials and choose to do so, they can only cover those that are making that minimum salary. Subsection C is a new subsection, and you should also have in your packets a one-page spreadsheet that's entitled FY08 Rate Adjustments Required to Recoup Excess Muni PERS Contributions for Prior 3 Years. When the administration introduced their bill, there was a packet of spreadsheets accompanying it, and they talked about what they referred to as the heroes, and basically those were the PERS employers that during the last 2 years, in the case of Soldotna, they had also made a deposit in 05 of $1 million. These were employers that, in addition to paying what they were required to pay, paid an additional amount of money, assuming that they were paying off their own individual liability. If we now go to a pooled shared liability system, those payments would have really been for naught. So, and the whole pool is now benefiting from their generosity. So what we've done in this bill is take those employers and put transitional language in that would set a 1 year contribution rate for those employers for FY08 that would allow them to recoup the money that they contributed over the last 2 years. And then in the beginning of FY09 contribution rate period, they would go to the 22% rate. And you'll see on the spreadsheet how that calculation was determined. And in the case of Soldotna, because the total amount of excess they've contributed, if you look at Soldotna, which is 5 up from the bottom at employer number 123, and you look at column 10, you'll see that they contributed in excess of $1.276 million, but their entire FY08 contribution rate at the 22% is only anticipated to be $537,000, which is in column 4. So there's no way they can recoup their excess in 1 year, so they'd still have contributed $649,000 more net than necessary, even at a contribution rate of zero for fiscal year 08. So it's contemplated, I think, that the legislature would perhaps put something in the capital bill to fix that. But and Mr. Chairman, those are the changes in the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Hey, Mr. Teal, if you could introduce yourself and who you represent and then go through your presentation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And I have some I guess, more of the fiscal side of the bill that I'm going to discuss. This chart is something that you saw in January during a budget presentation, and it's here only as a reminder. You know, it's been a month or so since this bill was in front of you, and this should recall the magnitude of the issue you're facing. And here, if you look at the retirement portions of the increments in the governor's budget in 08, you'll see $207 million here, $186 here, and then another $78 million for municipalities. So we're spending over $450 million in the 08 budget to fund these retirement increases. And those numbers are based on the 05 actuarial evaluation and a PERS contribution rate just under 40%. The preliminary 06 valuation put that rate close to 47%, and with a wage base of almost $1.7 billion, each percent carries with it $17 million worth of additional contributions. So the PERS contributions here could be off by as much, or understated by as much as $120 million. Another chart that you've seen before, this simply shows what the unfunded liability is, and I just wanted to recap a few points that we talked about a month ago when 125 was in front of you. That unfunded liability is likely to get larger before we begin to close the gap. Two reasons for that. One is that we've had a 5-point cap on annual rate increases, so we've been underfunding the system for a few years. And second is there's a 2 to 3 year lag between adopting rates and actually seeing the impact of those payments on the unfunded liability. Second is that this unfunded liability is not going to go away. I know that some states have chosen not to address it, but it's a bill that must be paid at some point. The state is going to be paying most of that bill either by appropriating money to the agencies, to the school districts, etc., and then they can pay DOA, or as we've done in the 08 budget, appropriating money directly to the Department of Administration on behalf of the employers. The cost of both the direct and indirect methods is identical in most cases. And finally, that simply paying the bill is not the same as fixing the system. So we have here is the impact. Miles Baker just described what the bill will do. And the bill sets fixed PERS rates. So with a little reminder, we can start moving forward. The goal here was to find a permanent fix that's affordable to both the state and its political subdivisions. There are three items that affect the cost or the affordability, depending on how you want to state that. The first is paying TERS costs directly to DOA. By doing that, we've reduced the employer contribution rate to 12.56 for TERS. And that saves $11 million annually on the university's optional retirement system. Those savings have already been discussed in the operating budget. They are taken in the operating budget. The TERS rate is, in fact, funded in the operating budget. So from the perspective of SB 125, this first point is not particularly interesting. The ARM board has passed a resolution in support of direct payments to DOA. It's in the House and Senate budget, and there's no impact beyond that unless you want to get into the K-12 funding. And I'm not going to talk about that here. This is strictly retirement, but when the K-12 bill comes in front of you, there's some issues with TERS that will come up at that time. So the other two items are where we spend most of the time here, and that's SB 125 caps employer contribution rates to PERS, as Miles Baker said, and then talk a little bit about actuarial methods. So the impact of a fixed rate is primarily on political subdivisions. The fixed rate doesn't reduce the total cost at all. It simply shifts the burden. And since the burden, whether the state pays school districts so they can pay the bill or pays DOA directly, the cost of TERS is the same, same with PERS. And that's true for every employer except the municipalities, because we have no legal obligation to pay their PERS bill. So that all we're doing with a fixed rate is shifting the cost from between the subdivisions and the state itself. When the Municipal League testified earlier, they mentioned three pillars: stability, predictability, and affordability. 125 is real clear on the first two pillars. A fixed rate is as stable and predictable as possible. The third pillar, affordability, is more complex. It's what we've spent most of our work on. We know the bill has to be paid. The question is, who's going to pay it, the state or the municipalities? And we know that in Senate Bill 125, it sets the employer rate in statute at 22% of payroll, with the state picking up the remainder of the cost. You can now go to a chart that explains some of this. The easy way to think of this is that municipalities pay 22% regardless of what the full rate is. These lines are the full rate as projected by Buck, the actuarial consultants. There are two lines here. The lower blue line is an actuarial method that was used when the defined benefit system was still an open system. There was a different method, a level dollar method, that was adopted by the ARM board because the actuary said it was the appropriate method to use for a closed system. Now, what you can't see in this chart is costs. You see rates only. So the next chart goes on to a representation of what costs would be to municipality or to the state under this 22% plan. You can see it starts out roughly $45 million, goes up, peaks in 2010, and then declines. Both of them, this is the level dollar rate, and this is the former rate or method that they used to use. Both decline. So we can also see that both of these payment schedules eliminate the unfunded liability in 25 years or less. Now, the unfunded liability is eliminated when the rate reaches the normal rate. The normal rate is simply the cost of funding the system on a continuing basis. It's the past service cost, which is simply defined as the cost to pay the unfunded liability, and that's everything above this normal cost rate. So you can see that the rate by the end of the amortization period is, in fact, below the normal cost rate, which means the unfunded liability has been paid off. Notice, though, that the rates actually go below the normal cost rate, don't just meet it gradually. What that implies is that rates in this period are too high. There's another concept here that you, Mr. Chairman, mentioned, that's risk sharing. The administration has expressed concern that 22% rate plan has too much risk involved because it gives the municipalities stability and predictability. Their cost will be 22%. The state will pick up the rest of that cost, and there's a certain amount of risk that goes with agreeing to pick up excess costs when you don't know what those excess costs will be. So you'll probably be discussing risk sharing, but it's not in the bill. The reason that the decision that it wasn't in the bill originally is that you can see that rates are declining. Declining rates mean the risk declines. We don't expect rates to continue to go up as we feared when we first started looking at the cost of fixing the rate at a 22% rate. There's some things here that aren't in the charts. One is that funding at this level, using the level dollar contribution method, is already in the FY08 budget. The $125 million that are required to get to the funding method that the board has adopted is not yet in the budget. Second is that the revised revenue forecast that came out last week essentially eliminates the FY08 surplus, and a deficit is projected for FY09. That raises questions about the wisdom of paying as much as possible as soon as possible. We simply don't have the cash flow, or may not have the cash flow, to pay high rates and high cash flow in these early years. Third important point that you can't see here is which line you should be using. In discussions with Buck, the consultants, we've learned that the rate adopted by the board was appropriate for a closed system, but that between SB 123, which is now in the House, as long as that bill passes, the full wage base will be subject to contribution. Because the full wage base is subject to contribution, the PERS system will no longer act as a closed system. We know that technically it's closed. No employees can join defined benefit system. But from a funding perspective, the employer will be paying the same contributions on new employees as they are on existing employees, so that the system, for actuarial purposes, acts like an open system. Because of that, you don't need to go to the higher rate schedule. So where do we go from here? We're continuing to work with the ARM board to revise the actuarial method and to reset the FY08 rates. Again, the objective is to get to a permanent, affordable fix for the burden that the contribution rates above 22% would place on political subdivisions. What we hope to get from Buck this week is a smooth curve that pays off the unfunded liability in 25 years and essentially follows a line something from in here down to the unfunded liability or the normal cost rate in 25 years, and just follows a smooth curve doing that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Teel. Do we have any questions for Mr. Teel or on the bill before we bring up the administration? Okay, seeing none, we're going to take a brief, just a second. Senator Thomas.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
David, on page 3, the third bullet, each point means a $17 million cost increase, so the amount of PERS contribution could increase another $120 million in fiscal year 09. Where do you get that calculation from? What causes you to believe that, I guess?
Well, the total wage base, through the chair, Senator Thomas, the total wage base for all PERS employees is about $1.7 billion. So for each percent that you must pay into the retirement system, the cost is about $17 million. And if rates were going from 40 to 47, you're going up 7 points, each costing $17 million, so the product of that's about $120 million.
Okay, good, thanks.
Fairfax Center Pumps. Okay, with that, we're going to take a brief at ease while we drop the projector and roll up the screen. So it's just going to be about a minute. We're at ease. We'll come back on the record. Ms. Annette Kreitzer, is she in the room? There she is. She could come forward, jump in the hot seat, and bring forward whatever backup staff she feels appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Annette Kreitzer, I'm Commissioner Designee for the Department of Administration, and I will say the seat's still warm, so it feels a little bit like the hot seat. I understand that there are a couple of issues that you wanted to touch on, Mr. Chairman. One of them is why the administration included a 90-day or the ability for municipalities to amend their participation agreements within a 90-day period from the effective date of the bill. Is that correct?
Correct.
We did have some debate about this, about whether when moving to a cost-share plan, we should just say that's it. When the bill is effective, that's the end of the story, and what you've got in your participation agreements are what you have to live with. And I didn't feel like that was a fair arrangement for the municipalities because I knew there was some concern about a 65-35 agreement or proposal. I knew there were things in the bill that municipalities were not going to be happy with, and so we were trying to provide some flexibility at the local level. In the other body, there was an amendment to add coverage for local elected officials who make a floor, a certain amount. And so that's been added into this 90-day provision. If you're going to add back in local elected officials, then they have to make that floor. There may be other ways to get to the same thing that we were trying to get to, which was to allow a little bit of flexibility for the local municipalities and yet not allow for gamemanship in terms of moving folks in and out. I understand that that's another concern of the committee, and I think we need to have a little bit of further discussion on that, and we will before Wednesday, which I understand you want to take the bill back up again, and we'll come to you with some suggestions that we might have.
Ms. Christer, could you explain the potential gaming issue a little bit just for the folks at home so they follow the concern that's on the table about that issue?
Mr. Chairman, I'll try, and Pat Shire, who's the director of the Retirement Benefits Division, can jump in if I miss something. My understanding is that as you move covered employees in and out of your participation agreement, you shrink the amount of your payroll base, and that's the concern, is are you going to then, especially when you go to a cost-share system, force folks to pay for members that you had opted out of, that you had taken out of the PERS system, that now you may in this 90-day period want to add back in. And that's what I'm referring to when I'm talking about a little bit of gamesmanship. There may be other issues that other members are aware of or that Pat's aware of.
Senator Elton.
Well, on that issue, I mean, in some ways, gamesmanship is a semi-pejorative term. And there have been decisions made by municipalities, and I'll use an example in my community where the airport manager was a retired person who was rehired, and that position was removed from the PERS plan because of that. And so my understanding from you now is that the community of Juneau is going to have 90 days to make a decision on whether that's a PERS position or not a PERS position because the airport manager isn't going to be there forever. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Elton, that's correct. And I apologize for using the term gamesmanship. I did tag on to what the chairman said, and I do understand that there are communities that make decisions for different reasons.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please continue with your presentation.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Pat Shire, the recently appointed director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and I'd point out under Section 9 for the PERS employees, this is a section that actually takes care of some of that issue of what happens when you have retirees coming back and the difficulty that a municipality might have in deciding how to treat an individual who's valuable, who comes back to work. Now this new section would is it states 22% employer contribution rate applies to retiree and rehires, and their salary must be included in the payroll base. That's part of the new funding calculation.
And then, Mr. Chairman, to continue, as you know, I have concerns about the state taking on anything greater than 22% that's undefined, and I've talked to you privately about that, and I've talked to the legislators about that. And we'll probably continue to talk about it over the next couple of days. I also just want to make the point that I don't think either of our plans is a permanent fix. I know that in David Teal's presentation, he talks about a permanent fix, and I've also had this conversation with David and with your staff that the cash flow problem, it is going to be a problem in the next couple of years, I believe, and we'll see whether the 22% rate holds with the state paying everything greater than that. The other piece that I would like to bring up again is that I do believe a cash infusion into TERS, no matter what that amount might be, is something that the legislature should still consider when we look at this entire problem, Mr. Chairman. Those are all the comments I was prepared to make today, but I'm happy to entertain questions committee members might have.
When we look at the bill in front of us along with the fix-it bill, there are the two big pieces we're working on this year. The next big component is to take the liability, once it's totally isolated, which we're working on here, and look at the cash flow, which was represented in the slideshow here, or the presentation by Ledge Finance, and work on slicing that up and minimizing the impact on the general fund draw. So we've got one more big piece coming, and then hopefully we'll have this mess behind us.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do want to make one comment on the slide presentation. I noticed that David had pegged the unfunded liability at 6.9, and I think we both realize it's closer to 8.6.
Right. And I just on that point, it's correct. It, depending on what year of the valuation and what you're using, and the numbers have been on the table at 6.9 or up in the 8 to 10. So you have to pick a point of valuation and then layer work out. But as we all recognize, every fiscal year, the last several, it's been incremental increases in that liability. So that, we're aware of that.
Thank you.
Do we have any initial questions for the administration? Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this may be a question you need to get back to me on. Because it's semi-specific. I need to know what the 90-day effect is on those issues that may be at the administrative hearing point. I'm thinking specifically of the dispute between the City and Borough of Juneau and the department on how we handle some of the Juneau Police Department employees. And I need to know if the 90-day provision gets in the way of an administrative hearing process that may not be completed until fall.
Through the chair, Senator Elton, yeah, I will have to get back. I know exactly the disputes that you're talking about, and I'd just like to confer with law to determine if there is an impact there.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, Same area of concern. It says on page 12, an employer may not award past service to employees added during the 90-day period. Is past service considered unearned? Could it potentially be? Do you grant service to employees that are not previous employees? That's sometimes done in other industries, but I didn't know if it was done with the state or not, so more question, not understanding. Whether at this point in time or not, do municipalities, are they allowed, I guess to try and make it clear, are municipalities allowed to grant past service to people that have not been an employee in the past?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I don't believe so. But I know that this section was very specifically written, and we were trying to be very, very clear about what options were available to municipalities here. And I don't believe so, but I'd like to double check with law.
Okay, if you would. Thank you.
Senator Huggins.
I'm not sure where it fits in the category, but there are some provisions for military service, and I'm not sure where that gets to your question or not, but there are some provisions. 5 years.
Seeing no further questions for the administration, you don't go far. I'd like to call on Mr. Larry Simmons, who's online from Kenai.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. My name is Larry Simmons. I'm the finance director of the city of Kenai, and I'm a member of the ARM board. I just want to say thanks to everyone who has continued the hard work on this PERS and TERS issue. I'd like to speak today because I'm going to be traveling tomorrow to Juneau, and I don't know when your next committee hearing is, so I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I understand, I think, what's going on page 4, line 18, having to do with the ARM board setting the amortization period over 25 years, but I'd like to have it clarified that we are not talking about a rolling 25-year period where every year the ARM board refinances essentially the unfunded liability over the next 25-year period. I note in there that you say we can set the 25-year period, but it just occurs to me that if we set a rate based on the 06 valuation and calculate the liability over the next 25 years, where are we when we set a rate on the 07 valuation? Do we have 25 years again, or are we able to say, well, now the liability is X, and we're going to amortize that over the next 24 years. And at some point I'd like to get some clarification on that. Go ahead.
I'll just clarify that right now. Historically, there was this rolling amortization of the unfunded liability, and it just rolls in front of you basically for decades. The intent here is to amortize and liquidate this liability over the next 25 years. So your concern is well taken, Mr. Simmons, but I think the intent here is to get this liability behind the state and not to roll it in front of it.
Well, I appreciate that clarification. That would be that'd be the way I'd like to see it. Section 9, employers will welcome the certainty of a set rate. We were hoping for a slightly lower rate, obviously. I've testified to a 20% rate in the past. Won't belabor that today. But I would like to say that many employers have already set their FY08 rate based on the governor's budget, which would have held them to a 5% increase over their out-of-pocket 07 costs. For the city of Kenai, if we just went with the governor's budget plan, which would be a 5% increase, that would amount to a 36% increase over the amount that we paid in 07 out of our own pockets, not considering the state's 5% PERS aid. And I have personally, in the city of Kenai budget, I have included that 36% increase. However, if you cause us to jump all the way to 22%, that'll be a 60% increase in the amount that the city of Kenai will have to pay. And I'd like the legislature to consider adopting the governor's plan for municipalities regarding the amount of money that'll come out of our pockets in 08. Section 12 on page 9, I'm just a little confused, and obviously I just got this morning, first time I've looked at this particular committee substitute, but I'm concerned that line 31 on page 9, it says regardless of employer status at date of termination. I don't know exactly what we're getting at there, but it seems like a former employee, in other words, not an active employee, should not be impacted by an employer's termination and therefore should not vest. And I don't know if that's what that section's getting at or not, but I'm concerned about how I read it. In section 15 regarding terminations, it's 60 days. I just have to tell you, 60 days is not a very long time for a municipality to either pay their termination bill or or work out a payment plan that gets approved through their legislative body and so on. I just want to bring that point out. In Section 16, I'd like to point out, too, I agree that the state must have some ability to calculate a termination, because we're going to a cost-share plan that typically a cost-share plan does not keep track of individual employer assets or liabilities. And, you know, right now the state cannot tell an individual employer what their asset or their unfunded liability really is. So I'm concerned about how this is going to work. Not so much that we need, that we don't need a termination plan, but exactly how it's going to work. And I don't know if you do that in legislation or regulation. I do appreciate Section 19 that you're paying attention to elected officials, but the main thing in this section is that municipalities will be held to the classes of employees that they have at the end of that 90-day period. And I think that's really bad public policy. I don't think it fixes the problem of an immediate or abrupt change in an employer's salary base. For example, if Kenai were to opt out or to contract out its street department, it would not affect or be affected by opting classes of employees out. That would do nothing. Because that class of employee would still be part of our plan, but our salary would drop precipitously, and the rest of the members, particularly the state, would pay for it. You mentioned that in your opening remarks, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that that's on the table. But I just want to strenuously object to the provision that a municipality going forward will not be able to add or delete classes of employees. I can think of multitudes of situations where that will be very important to municipalities to be able to do that. And what I would suggest is that a different method to deal with the impacts of particularly opting classes of employees out be adopted. And that's all I have this morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Simmons. And I look forward to your enthusiastically reading the bill on your flight to Juneau and your visit to the office, which I'm sure you're going to grace yourself in the office. So.
Yeah, I'll be there. Thank you very much.
I'd like to call on Mr. Michael Lamb, who's online from Fairbanks, North Scarborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. My name is Michael Lamb, Chief Financial Officer, Fairbanks North Star Borough. And I guess just to save time, I have to very much mimic the comments Larry made. We haven't spoken at all, and I just saw this morning. But I do have the same concerns, and at the same time, I very much appreciate the time and effort that's been put into this committee substitute. And I heard Commissioner Kreitzer speak of the concern of why the 90 days was brought up. And in fact, Larry and I talked about the same issue, the shrinking of a salary base. And we never used the word gamesmanship, but the concern that in the future certain things could be done perhaps that would end up shrinking a salary base where other employers would end up sharing or having to cover the cost. And so shrinking the salary base is an issue, but the 90 days probably is not the best way to get there. And so I think we all actually have the same concern. And I would just hope that perhaps we can find something that's a better target. And certainly some of the language previously put in here, which was discussed earlier, that said that no matter if somebody's coming in or not, whatever the rate is whatever the rate is, would help take care of that. But there is the issue of if you decide to contract out some particular service, you really do shrink the salary base. And I know there's been discussion about setting a minimum, having increased by 1%. And I know even the AML's position, it talked about setting the 2006 salary base as the base until the past service cost was set off. So whatever method is used to assure that we take care of that concern, we should do it. I just have real issue with the limitations in the box that gets created with the 90 days. All of the stuff that's in this bill, the flat TERS rate, doing the direct payments, the 25-year amortization, all the points that David Teal brought up, which we, Larry and I and David, talked extensively about last week, make a huge difference to understanding the state's volatility out in the future, which is a legitimate concern. I'm not in any way minimizing it, but I think that helps greatly alleviate that concern, and I look very forward to getting another report from Buck. You know, essentially, I am very pleased with the way that things have come together, and I applaud the effort of everyone, and certainly you, Senator Stedman, and I certainly am one that I'm not gleeful because there's a couple things in here that I'd like to see changed, but all in all, I have to tell you, I'm very pleased with where this has turned out, and I certainly support it, and I hope my fellow member employers also likewise support it. And that's about the end of my comments, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb, and I'd appreciate you taking some more time over the next day or so to, you know, read through the bill and then correspond with my office on your concerns. I know you've been involved in this for quite some time.
Thank you, sir. I'll do that.
We have been summoned to the floor. Is there any quick questions before we set this aside for a couple of days?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. At some point, I think we need to have a discussion at the table about, I mean, we have a list of municipalities that begins on page 12 that were previously called heroes. But there is another list of municipalities that may not have been heroes, but who are going to see their contribution rates go up under the bill, and many of those are the smaller communities. And at some point, we need to have a discussion on the impacts of not doing something with them. For example, I'm concerned that they may opt just out of the system, period, and I'm not sure that's a good result. So we need to talk about those other 20 or 25 employers also.
Any other final questions, comments from the committee members? Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for a couple of days. We're going to try to bring it up Wednesday. We've got some policy issues we're working on along with the administration. If we can get it up Wednesday, we're going to. Finance is scheduled for both morning and afternoon, and we're going to be working on a GIA, so the schedule is going to be a little bit mixed.
Mr. Chairman, before you adjourn, if you'd entertain, we do have a quick answer to Senator Thomas's question, if you'd like to hear that.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, the military service provision would be unaffected, but what we were seeking to do was prevent credit for non-PERS service for those groups of employees that may, in that period of time, opt in. We didn't want to be retrospective in granting service that was not service in PERS until that moment.
We're going to stand in recess till 2 p.m. And again, please take note that's an abnormal time for the starting of the afternoon, but we're just going through adjustments. Meeting in recess.